So now, not if I get that right out of you, not only are you bonded to me, you're much more honest with me. And also when you say that's right, it's deeply satisfying to you to feel heard. Having felt heard, you're satisfied you want less, which makes you more collaborative. You're less demanding. So getting a that's right out of somebody bonds them to me, makes them more honest, and makes them less demanding, which is kind of what every salesperson wants to move the deal forward.
Welcome to Life After Corporate, your ultimate guide for making the leap from corporate leader to entrepreneur. I'm Deb Boulanger, entrepreneur, executive leader, and founder of the Launch Lab for Women Entrepreneurs. This is your time to break through the glass ceiling once and for all and get your ticket to the C-suite. Come back each week to get the leading strategies, advice, and tools that will give you the skills and confidence you need to replace your corporate paycheck. Are you ready? Let's go. Welcome back to another episode of Life After Corporate, my friend. And if you're new to our show, welcome home. This is where you get the straight scoop on what it really takes to launch and grow a sustainable coaching and consulting business. And today, I have a very special guest to introduce you to. And that was my late night DJ voice. Today, Chris Voss is with us. If you haven't heard of Chris Voss, he is the author of Never Split the Difference. And my backstory on first being introduced to Chris was being on an airplane, heading to Florida for a business meeting, and tuning in to the masterclass on negotiation that Chris had recorded. And I was completely riveted by the conversation. I binged every single lesson in that series, realizing that this was so important for women entrepreneurs to understand because this was all about sales. So Chris, I know you have been a street cop, an FBI hostage negotiator, the founder of the Black Swan Group. You've done sales training. Welcome to Life After Corporate. I'm fangirling all over here. It's so thrilling to have you on the show.
Oh, it's absolutely my pleasure.
Well, Chris, that was the beginning of me getting in touch with what you had to offer. Bought the book, Never Split the Difference, and have read it all. Recommended reading for all of my clients. But I'm so fascinated by your story and your career and how you've established your reputation as really the leading authority on negotiations in the world. And maybe that's how I see it. And while I have a million questions that I'd love to ask you, I'm going to focus on conversation today on new entrepreneurs and the transition from corporate to founder and the skills in sales in order to close business and grow. And so much of sales is based on psychology. So I'd love to talk about what was your experience going from a street cop to FBI negotiator? What was the training? What was the development? What was your passion that led you there?
Well, first of all, I think I'm coachable and I like to take initiative. And I like to find the stuff that works. So what does that mean? When I was a cop, I started out early, pretty much like every young rookie cop, you know, crime fighter. It's a highly adrenaline charged job if you're into it. And especially if you feel a sense of purpose about it, you know, it matters to you to catch bad guys and to stop the bad guys from doing bad things to good people.
Okay.
So, but then what does that mean when you start out without a lot of great instruction? And there ain't a lot of great instruction. Law enforcement training is still very, very much behind, but you don't get a lot of really good instruction on how to talk to people. So I really didn't know how to talk to people. I was lucky enough that a bunch of detectives with the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department, the detectives were having a dispute with management. And they claimed that becoming a detective was tantamount to a promotion, but they didn't get paid any. And one of their points for proof that it was promotion, they should get paid more than uniform cops, was nobody that once they made detective ever went back to uniform. And so you got to be careful what argument you make. Well, the police department said, oh, okay, we're going to put a bunch of you back in uniform to prove that that's not true. So a lot of people that were really good at talking to folks got kicked out of the detective bureau, put back in uniform in cars with people like me who didn't know how to talk to people. And I can remember one guy in particular, just with this soft, gentle tone of voice, was changing things instantly. And I was like, wow, that's cool. And so that really struck with me. You know, I'm coachable and I want to learn how to do something better. So I'd learned about tone of voice, not really realizing it was a critical part of negotiation, but that was in my, you know, my early cop days. Then I'm in the FBI. I'm on a SWAT team for a variety of reasons. I decided I want to become a negotiator. I figured, you know, how hard could it be? My son and I joked that one of the unofficial Voss family mottos is how hard could it be, which is very similar to a redneck's famous last words, hey, watch this. You don't know what you're getting yourself into. And so I couldn't get on the negotiation team because I wasn't qualified. And I was told to volunteer on a suicide hotline, and I did. And while I was on, kind of by accident, you know, because I was very nervous to start with, the first call I took, I just said, hello, this is Helpline. Just like that. Mm-hmm. And afterwards, the supervisor said, wow, your voice was great. You know, that was a great tone of voice. And I remember thinking, well, what did I do? I didn't even remember. And I think I lapsed into that voice for whatever reason, because I was concerned. And I was overly conscious of not having a negative impact. And so then that began to put the pieces together on tone of voice. And then I was lucky enough, I got selected to go train. Then I volunteer. I'm sitting in the office one day and somebody says, hey, there's a bank robber in Brooklyn. Let's go. And we just went. And that was really a critical moment in my career, being willing to step up after feeling I had a good process. I knew I had a good process. And I was, if you have a good process, nothing's perfect. You just want the best process that could be. And you kind of jump in.
Yeah, that was a great story in the book. And so what you talked about is really the ability to have conversations that establish rapport, gain trust, and get them to share their needs, right? So that's what negotiation is. And that's what sales is too. Yeah. But typically, especially when it's a new skill to you, it feels really uncomfortable. And so how can you diffuse the fear and shift the energy to be able to get down to business? So I'm sitting here, I've got a service that I want to sell. You're a prospective client. What are some of the techniques that you employed in hostage negotiations that are also applicable to sales conversations?
First of all of them are, but you know, the subtle point of that a lot of people miss, you know, you said the first step is establish rapport. Like the vast majority of ways we're taught to establish rapport is just dead wrong or really, really inefficient.
Yeah.
And why is that so pervasive? Because we don't have a lot of good examples. I mean, to me, I blame mostly the movies and TV. You know, the movies and TV show really bad ways to establish rapport constantly. However, since the writer controls the dialogue, then the writer thinks that's a way to establish rapport. And what's depicted for us is that it works when it doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
You're like, hey, I've been there. I suffered loss too. You know, I know how you feel. That you see that in movies and TVs all the time. And a point of fact, it's almost always offensive. So this whole establishing rapport thing, why is it so? Why does it take you out of your comfort zone? Because the best way to do it is pretty much like nothing you've seen. And so suddenly you're like, wait a minute, but that's not how they do it on TV. And you haven't really seen what it takes. So, you know, since I went to the hotline to learn a skill, they taught me a way to establish rapport. The fastest way and the most effective way was to be really to be a great sounding board. What does that mean? Somebody got on the hotline one time and just, I just want you to know, I'm trying to put a lid on this day. I'm trying to put a lid on this day. So I help them sound that out. I send that emotion out and I say, you sound frantic. Now, most people learning on TV, you know, the TV dialogue would be like, I know how you feel. I once felt I had to put a lid on a day myself. And since I was just following a training on the hotline, I didn't make that stupid mistake. And so really establishing rapport quickly and effectively to do it well is vastly counterintuitive to the way most people see it. I'm at a sales training yesterday and for a company, I'm giving a keynote speech. And myself and the other Black Swan trainer, Don, are sitting there going like, you're not going to believe what they just said. They told these people, like, make sure you reiterate your value proposition. You know, that's making it all about you. That ain't establishing rapport. That's talking at people.
That's a pitch.
You know, and I said, thank God that people are still being taught to do that, because we will never run out of customers, because it is so bad.
So bad.
And in point of fact, you know, I get a demand gen, I get assessments constantly on sales behavior and what makes people buy from you. What makes people buy from you is your knowledge of what they're facing, which is not your value proposition. Now, at some point in time, your value proposition becomes important to them, but you don't establish rapport with anybody by giving them your value proposition. You establish rapport by saying things like, you're living in an uncertain world. Every time we think we got the economy figured out, we have a pandemic, or Russia invades Ukraine, or Hamas attacks Israel and Israel retaliates with a scorched earth mentality, thereby screwing up supply chains worldwide, interfering with global distribution, throwing all the predictions of the economy out of whack, and you're just not sure how to plan for that.
That's right.
That has nothing to do with your value proposition, but it's letting your customer know you see what they're up against.
Exactly.
So this first part of it is so counterintuitive to what most people think.
Yeah. So in your masterclass, you talked about, in the book, you talk about mirroring, labeling, which I think you were just doing, and if I got it right, and really things like NLP, right? Neuro-linguistic programming types of techniques. So let's walk through a sales conversation and let's walk through the structure of open-ended questions, you know, the labeling, the mirroring. How does it all unfold? I think that would be a very useful framework to hear.
Well, in a sales conversation, first of all, your customer probably already knows your value proposition.
Mm-hmm.
You know, basically, the buying journey is a 9-step journey. They've done their research on you. They've asked around about you. There's a whole progression of things that people do based on human nature. The first thing anybody does when they're trying to find out is they Google something. They don't ask anybody, because when you ask somebody a question, everybody's horrified at appearing stupid. So they're going to at least Google you before they start asking an ever increasingly wide circle of advisors. And they're going to go through a checklist of the people that they are least embarrassed by appearing ignorant in front of. And it's going to be a progression of family and friends, colleagues. And then finally, when they ask their truly trusted advisors, you really want to know what they're talking about. So there's this whole succession of information, which means they already know your value proposition. What they want to find out is, what do you know? And how are you able to tailor that to them?
Well.
Knowing that that's uppermost in your mind, that's how you start the conversation. A salesperson, even if you're cold calling, they're not going to have a substantive conversation. Where you establish rapport is by saying out loud what's in the other person's head, not what should be in their head, because it's a shoulddy world, but what is in their head. And we teach people to say right off the bat, like, look, you know, I'm Chris, I'm from so-and-so. You're asking yourself right now, do I know what I'm talking about? You're asking yourself right now whether or not talking to me is going to be a waste of your time. Because that's what the voice in their head is saying. And as soon as you start saying what the voice in their head is saying, now you got rapport. Now you got alignment. Now they're thinking, now they can't wait to hear what you say next, which is exactly the point of the sales call.
Right.
Get their undivided attention. You don't eliminate the voice in their head. You show them that you know what the voice in their head is saying because you say it out loud. Now they don't have to listen so much to the voice in their head because you're synonymous with it. You're invited into their world. As soon as you start expressing to them by saying it out loud what they think.
Mm-hmm. And so for me, when I'm talking to clients, it's usually something like, or prospects, it's, I wonder if I can afford this. You know, I'm wondering what Deb has that I can afford, or if I'm going to be able to invest in this. And so that's one that I think comes up a lot, because whenever people change, whenever they do something that requires them to act differently or behave differently or invest money in a solution, it triggers all these unconscious things, right? So there's
exactly.
so much that you said in the book that resonated with me. It's because it's really about the psychology of the conversation of, you know, what is going to get someone to change the way that they believe about something or the way they handle it by taking action. And so would love for you to talk about this conversation. So you're identifying what's in their head. You're bringing that up front. What's the next step? What is it that you want to draw out of the person that you're speaking with, and how do you do that?
Well, what I'm really driving for is I'm trying to do two things simultaneously and establish your rapport. I'm also, you got to manage the clock. You got to manage the calendar, because you're conditioning people with how conversations are going to go with you. And the dangerous thing about rapport is if you really establish rapport, there's a really good chance that the conversation is going to need to go longer than they've allocated for it.
No.
So the first thing is, in managing time, you got to eliminate uncertainty over time, because the single biggest stressor in life, when I tried out for the FBI's hostage rescue team, like all special forces, and the hostage rescue team is the FBI's version of the Navy SEALs. They want to max your stress. They want to see if they can break you, because if they can break you in training, then what good are you on a battlefield? How do they max your stress out with uncertainty? How do they do that? They just don't tell you anything. Like, they would take us for a run and they'd say, start running. And everybody that was there was in such good physical condition and had run so much. If you tell me how far we're going to go, I know exactly how fast to run. We're going a mile. I'm going to probably try to knock down a 6-minute mile or less. We're going 5. I'm probably going to want to run about 7.5, 8 minutes. Just tell me and I'll be fine. And they knew that all they had to say is, like, we're not telling you, you know, we're finished when we're done, because it would stress us out. So if uncertainty stresses out the special forces, toughest types, the Jocko Willinks, the Navy SEALs, it stresses everybody else out. How do you manage that? You and I get on a phone call, I'm going to ask you for an odd number of minutes. If I think I need 13 minutes, I'm going to ask you for 17. And I'm going to finish. If we're getting to 16 minutes, I'm cutting off the call, because I need to condition you that I will never steal time from other portions of your calendar. Because if I establish rapport with you, we could have this phenomenal 45-minute call, and I have just screwed up the rest of your day. And what's the implication of that? The next time you see my name on the phone, if you don't have 45 minutes, you ain't answering. And I know that moment's coming. So I will always stick to a time frame or less, because now I'm giving you back time and everybody else is stealing time. So I'm going to manage the process. I'm going to know the points that I want to hit. The danger of rapport is taking people out of their day. And I'm not going to let that happen, no matter how good it is. So I'm going to look for very specific points that I want to make in the call. And if nothing else, even if I get nowhere on the call with you, if I finish before the time you've given me, I'm the only person in your world that puts time back in your day. And that makes me an extremely valuable person who's always going to be worth talking to.
Wow, that is so counterintuitive. You know, so opening up the call and saying, we have 25 minutes or we have 27 minutes for this call, ending at the 25-minute mark, makes you reliable and trustworthy. So that's an interesting piece of psychology right off the bat. And then where do you go from there? What is the next question that you open up for? Because you said you already know what you want to say. So what is that question structure? How does that next, you know, 16 or 25 minutes unfold?
Well, no matter what in the conversation, and you know, you said a that's right to me earlier, you know, that's right is a magic response.
Yes.
That's right is what people say when they not only feel heard, and they feel that what they heard was the truth. Now, I may have the perfect solution for you as a salesperson, but if I don't make you feel listened to, you're not going to buy it. And everybody listening to this, I would ask you, how much time do you have for people who don't listen to you? Like, you don't even care if they're right. You get zero time for it.
Right.
Because the problem is, at some point in time, there's going to be a misalignment and an adjustment is going to be needed. And if my counterpart's not listening to me, they're never going to catch it. Best indicator of future behavior is past behavior. If you don't listen to me at all, if you're not hearing me, there's a train wreck coming. The train's coming off the tracks and you're not going to see it coming and it's going to be a mess. So my real challenge is, in really short, small, simple ways, I need to make sure that you feel heard. Plus, I'm looking for those moments of misalignment that are coming. So I'm going to label what you said. I'm going to mirror what you said. Mirror is just a repetition of 1 to 3 words. I'm never going to say I understand. That doesn't make people feel hurt, because they don't know what you understood. You have to articulate what you understood just to check to see that you're in alignment. And then that increases both rapport and trust. simultaneously so that you feel that I'm competent to be able to adapt to your needs. And that's the next phase of why somebody buys from you. You understand the landscape, and then you understand what they need. Therefore, if you've got those two things, you can construct a plan that'll work.
Mm-hmm.
Without those things, your plan sounds like it's maybe Starlink's first plan to put a rocket in outer space. And Starlink has blown up a number of rockets.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't want to be on that rocket that blows up.
Right. So I want to talk about that's right. I want to start where you started, right? So that's right is better than yes. And that was a big eye-opener for me in the book. And why is yes not the answer that you want to get from a prospect? And why is it important to get to that's right?
Well, anybody over the age of 18 years old has bought something based on the yes momentum. Do you want to make more money? Yes. Do you want to live in a big house? Yes. Do you want to have discounts from every store in your neighborhood? Yes. Buy this coupon. And then you couldn't use a coupon. So the yes momentum is a sales approach. Momentum selling is an effective approach to get you from being failing to being a C student. Now, people will become addicted to that because from their perspective, if you're failing, if you're an F student in college, they throw you out. On your job, you get fired. If you're a C student in college, you get a stay and you're going to graduate. And that beats the heck out of getting thrown out.
Yeah.
And a C student in an organization, you keep your job. You don't get fired. And so you become very addicted to this. The problem with people running it over and over again, the unsavory salespeople that are convincing people to buy something that doesn't really fit, the customer learns, okay, so they're trying to get me to say yes. They're taking me someplace. Since I don't know what it is, I'll give them a counterfeit yes. Because now I want to gather information. I want to see what they got. Maybe I could do it myself. Maybe I can see what they got and I can go to somebody else and I say, hey, you know, Chris Voss got this thing over here. They do this. Can you duplicate it? Because he just told me, I give him a counterfeit yes. And he spilled his guts to me. You know, Jim Camp in his book called it Spilling the Beans, you know, giving the other side all the information. So then people learn that if they give the counterfeit yes, you'll be so happy that you will tell me everything. You'll tell me your trade secrets. You'll tell me your product implementation. You'll explain how your product works. You'll give me free consulting to the point where I don't need you
anymore. Ooh.
Yeah.
I love this. I love this. So I know everyone who's listening to this right now has experienced the counterfeit yes, right? So the people that keep themselves psychologically safe and pull as much information out of you by keep saying yes to everything that you ask. Are you ready to move forward? Are you ready to learn more? All of those. And they say, yes, yes, yes. And then they ghost you and you never see them again.
Right.
So how do you get to that's right? And why is that important?
Well, you start paraphrasing what they're saying. You start paraphrasing their perspective. You want to get yourself to the point where you can summarize the situation. And the smaller tools, the labels and the mirrors are designed to gather the facts and how they feel about the facts. And paraphrasing is also designed to together the facts and make people feel hurt, but they're actually informational flow tools. I'm going to start to get you to flow information to me on a regular basis. I'm either going to confirm the information, or the crazy thing is, every time we get it wrong, you're going to correct me because you can't help yourself. People just can't hold back when they're corrected. So my design then, ultimately, if I get a that's right out of you, you feel really heard at least. And then if you feel really heard, you start to bond to me. What I'm trying to do is trigger something. The neurochemical of oxytocin. Oxytocin is known as the bonding drug. Some people mistakenly refer to it as the love drug, you know, the parenting drug. When your child is born, you get a solid hit of oxytocin. You're bonded to that kid for eternity. What oxytocin also does is incline you to tell the truth. So now, if I get a that's right out of you, not only are you bonded to me, you're much more honest with me. And also when you say that's right, it's deeply satisfying to you to feel heard.
Mm-hmm.
Having felt heard, you're satisfied you want less, which makes you more collaborative, you're less demanding. So getting a that's right out of somebody bonds them to me, makes them more honest, and makes them less demanding. which is kind of what every salesperson wants to move the deal forward.
Yes. And so saying things, the subtleties in here are not saying, if I heard you correctly. Instead, it sounds like.
The really tiny thing that a lot of people miss is no word is either good or bad. The issue is context. What am I driving at? I'm driving at the use of the word I.
Okay.
I is a very self-centering thing in subtle ways. And so when I say, what I'm hearing you say is, I've self-centered in a way that causes a little bit of discomfort with you. You're not really sure it's bad, but in this tiny way on a scale, and everything's on a scale, nothing's neutral. In a tiny little way, the self-centering is on me is uncomfortable. I'm more interested in my perception than I am in yours.
Okay.
So what I'm hearing is a self-centering thing that in the moment is counterproductive. If you simply say, you sound like, then I haven't done the self-centering. I've centered on you. And you like that. It feels good to you in that context.
So it's not I or it, it's you. So you want to get real personal. You sound like.
Each word has a different emotional impact. And how do you learn which one? Only through practice. You take the basic skills and small stakes practice for high stakes results is the Black Swan mantra, you know. I practice on my Lyft driver. I practice on a grocery store clerk. You know, it looks like if someone's got a frown on their face, I don't say, how are you? Because they got a frown on their face. I can tell that they're not doing well. Or they either are unhappy or they have gas. So I'll say, you know, it looks like you're having a tough day. And they'll feel seen.
Yeah.
But it also gives me practice of, am I going to use it? Or you, and then I feed my supercomputer, my gut instinct, and I get better at it.
Yeah, you do have a supercomputer, that's for sure. Yes, I was practicing on my partner, and he said, will you just stop saying what I'm saying? I was mirroring with a little inflection at the end. He was like, will you please just stop that? So let's move on. We only have about 10 more minutes, and I want to get to the emotional drivers, the unseen, unspoken needs that people really have. And how you uncover those in these sales conversations.
Well, there's some table stakes. The table stakes are fear of loss. It's always table stakes.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know the source of the stat. I believe it to be true. I wish I could cite the source. I heard a long time ago that 70% of buy decisions are made to avoid a loss, not to accomplish a gain. I do also know from prospect theory, Danny Kahneman, Nobel Prize winner, behavioral economics, a loss thinks twice as much as an equivalent gain. So what somebody's most afraid of losing is going to have the biggest impact on their decision. So I'm looking for it, and I'm looking to articulate it. You're worried about the impact it's going to have on your bottom line. That's simply saying out loud, bringing their fear of loss out into the open. I also know from neuroscience that the best way to deactivate fears are to simply say them out loud. Recognize the elephant in the room. Not denying it. I'd say, but that's not true, or I don't want you to be worried about the effect on the bottom line. Those are not recognitions, those are denials.
Mm-hmm.
So in a sales process, what they're worried about losing is going to have the biggest impact on their decision. And they're going to be worried about short-term and long-term. Short-term is, what's this costing me now? How do I get them to shift to the long-term to see the bigger picture? Then that's probably going to be a calibrated question, which is going to be asked in a really curious tone of voice. And curious is curious, upward inflection.
Mm-hmm.
The question is probably going to be, what happens if you do nothing? That's getting the shift into the long-term cost of inaction and out of the short-term cost of the immediate impact on the bottom line.
Exactly.
It's understanding what their fears are and in what time frame their fears are rooted. Present or the future.
Excellent. Excellent. And it's so true. I mean, people are way too focused on the short term in these discussions. They're focused on how much cash is in the bank. You know, can I afford this? Those are the internal dialogue questions that at least people I speak to get. So a couple more questions. One is, what do you do? How do you handle objections? I don't have time. It's not the right time. It's too expensive. I'm shopping around. You know, if you get to that point in the conversation, I'm assuming that you've done something wrong earlier on in the conversation. But what do you do if you find yourself at that spot?
Well, you know, there's an issue of, have I dug myself into a hole that I got to stop digging and to get out? Is it an objection because they've been pumping me for information, or is it a legitimate objection? I don't believe in overcoming objections. I believe in treating them as counteroffers in disguise.
Yeah, I love that.
So I don't have time. So it sounds like, labeled it. It sounds like is the beginning of a label. So it sounds like if you had more time, you could do it. You need to find out whether or not it's a time issue or whether or not you've been played for the fool.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how do you stop from being played for the fool in the first place? You know, we refer to that as proof of life. And we bring it up in the very beginning of the conversation, which is really like, why are you talking to me? Said just like that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the word why is an emotional intelligence. You know, the why word is an emotional intelligence tactical strike. Why always triggers defensiveness. Now, you may need to know why on a lot of things, but you better be darn careful about when you use the word, because the other side is going to get defensive. The only time it works to your advantage, if they have to defend you. And then, and only then, does it work to your advantage. And when you're in a black swan method, when you're in the midst of our coaching, after we teach you the basic skills of navigation, tactical empathy, labeling, mirroring, how to do it, how to get, that's right. The next phase of your training is really going to be proof of life, because a lot of people out there want free consulting.
Oh, amen to that.
And they get it. And our rule is, let them get it at somebody else's expense, not you.
Beautiful, beautiful. Those are golden nuggets. And I appreciate you so much for sharing so openly with our community. How do you find women in sales versus men in sales? So we talked about this a little bit before we hit record. Are women better salespeople? Are women better negotiators? You know, sometimes in the political landscape, in the corporate landscape, you don't find women in senior level positions because there is this impression that women don't make fast decisions, or that you don't have what it takes. So what happens in the sales situation?
All right, so emotional intelligence, sales, and negotiations. I think women have a head start on emotional intelligence. I think that's a nurturing thing. You know, there's a whole question, is it nature, is it nurture? A lot of arguments about what is nature per se. I haven't seen a lot of solid data that indicates differences. The reason why I think they have a head start on emotional intelligence, nurture-based, is because little boys are taught to fight and little girls are taught, even if you can beat up that little boy now, there's going to come a point in time when you can't anymore. Biology is going to overtake things, and you're going to have to learn how to exert power and influence without beating somebody up.
Mm-hmm.
And grown women, adult women, are constantly trying to nurture little girls how to be more emotionally intelligent. And that's why I believe they have a head start. We got unscientific, but data that I'm absolutely certain of, that women pick the good emotional intelligence-based negotiation up faster than men. Now, are they any better at it at the top end? I don't think there's any difference in top performance. I'm gender agnostic. All you got to be is coachable and willing to take initiative and like innovation. You know, if you're ambitious, by definition, you like to be innovative. If you have those characteristics, then at the top end, it's gender agnostic. Now, most negotiation is taught to be combative, you know, male dominated, you know, don't be a push-up, you know, be the loudest voice in the room, you know, kick a chair across the room, you know, pound your table, you know, the former founder of Blockbuster. That guy was famous for slamming his hands down on the table and storming out of meetings. And for a while, that works. And for a while, Blockbuster dominated the industry. And Blockbuster laughed at Netflix when Netflix wanted to be bought by Blockbuster. They were like, we're kicking your ass. You're never going to be anything. Well, look how that turned out. But there's been a lot of training for negotiation to be the loudest, most bullying voice in the room. And that's bad. And I think women are penalized for that more than men are. And since I don't teach bullying negotiation, that is not my problem. We teach emotional intelligence-based negotiation. And women pick it up faster initially than men do. But if you're a good student and you want to learn and you don't want to be a bully because it's going to cost you money, then you can be as good at it as anybody on the planet.
Yeah. So it's an even playing field. And I have a good friend who launched the company Girls Who Sell because I even told this to my son when he was growing up. I said, you learn sales skills because if you can sell, you can do anything. You can you'll always have a job. You'll always be employed. You can be an entrepreneur because selling is at the root of really any transaction that we have in life. And so, Chris Voss, thank you so much. I'm going to pull a quote from the book to close us out today. You get what you ask for, you just have to ask correctly. And it has been my honor to host you on Life After Corporate. Truly, you're a rock star in my book. So thank you so much for joining us. And if people want to follow you, obviously go buy the book, Never Split the Difference. Do you actually coach? Do you have any entrepreneur education? Do you do any online?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, wow. Tell us about it.
We got all of the above. And the best way is really to subscribe to our newsletter because it's actionable and it's concise and it's complimentary and it's a gateway. So blackswanltd.com, BlackSwanLTD.com is the website, upper right-hand corner. The newsletter is the edge. If you don't get an opportunity to sign up right away, click on the upper right-hand corner. The catalog of previous articles are there. You can search the articles and look for something that fits to your specific situation. And you can sign up, give us your email address, 7:30 in the morning on Tuesday, whatever time zone, wherever you are in the world. It's a perfect moment to get a small dose of actionable negotiation thoughts. And then it also puts you in a position to get updated on everything that we do to teach you and to meet you where you are.
Excellent. Well, Chris, I'm sure you just got a bunch of followers from this episode. And my friends, I want you to listen on repeat, get your notebook, start taking notes. There were gems that were dropped in this conversation today. So go to blackswanltd.com, subscribe to the newsletter, get all of these great resources. Chris Voss, thank you very much for joining us on Life After Corporate.
It was my pleasure, Deb. Thanks for having me on.
All right, that's it for now, my friends. We will see you next week. Thanks for listening, my friend. If you enjoyed this show, please head over to iTunes and subscribe and leave us a review. And be sure to hop over to the Life After Corporate Facebook group and join other growing entrepreneurs to get weekly tips on how to create more money and meaning doing work you love.